All right, welcome to another episode of Life 2.0 Podcast. I'm John St. Augustine, glad to have you with me as we take one more ride up the down staircase, go in the frickin' outdoor, do everything we can to make sense out of the senseless, and find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Okay, I hope wherever you're holed up, H-O-L-E-D or W-H-O-L-E-D, you get to choose. That's the great thing about words. You know, funny, not ha-ha funny, unless you think it's ha-ha funny. I find things amusing that I don't often laugh out loud, as many people do, but this is like an inner amusing thing to me. There is this thing on Facebook that has the memories in it, and every now and again stuff pops up and says, this is what you were doing a year ago or 2 years ago. It doesn't say it. I hear that in my head. So just as I was getting ready to put this podcast together that you're hearing right now, this is actually being done on a Friday. You're not going to hear it until Saturday. Full disclosure, always here at the Vaunted Studios, Life 2.0 Podcast. Full disclosure. So I'm doing it on a Friday. It'll be up tomorrow on Saturday. And that's like the big hit day for Life 2.0. I guess everybody, nobody's working anyway, but apparently Saturday's still a big download day. Anyway, I digress. And so a year ago, I had a podcast up, and there was this picture of a giant catfish, and it says, this is a catfish. It was set up as the Wednesday rant. So as I'm hearing it on a Thursday, last year, this date was a Wednesday. And I thought, what? And all of this, all it takes is for someone to comment on an old post, and it gets back into rotation. It's resurrected, for lack of a better term. And so this podcast got resurrected because one of the subscribers, and she knows who she is, she wrote wow on there in a comment. All of a sudden, this thing that's been sitting dormant for a year now gets pulled back into the fray, into the landfill of Facebook, and you can have at it. So anyway, I went back and listened to a little bit of what the heck I was talking about last year at this time in May of 2019, and it was about how difficult it is for us to understand each other when words that used to mean one thing now mean something else. For example, like spam. You know, when I was a kid growing up, it was like, you know, pork shoulder in a can with gelatin around it, and you ate it on Saturday or Sunday mornings and dipped it in mustard. At least that's what we did. And now it means something else, right? So I was having a little bit of fun with this, but there are some things that are serious in this, that each of us gets to decide what something means and what it doesn't. And it could be a very serious thing or not. And so add to that words that nobody can understand what the hell's going on here. And that was the whole idea with the catfish thing. And I used to go to Gompers Park, go fishing, and we'd catch bullheads and catfish. And now there's apparently something that I totally still don't understand about what a catfish is, and I don't want to. Something about putting up a fake profile, pretending you're something you're not so you can get in a relationship. I don't know. It's bullshit. A catfish lives in the water, okay? It's got whiskers. You put a worm on a hook. You go to the Gompers Park Lagoon, you throw the worm in, you don't use a bobber. Why? Because the hook needs to sink to the bottom, and then that's where the catfish lives. So the rest of it, I don't get at all. Don't want to. But that little lead-in about something being pulled up from a year ago is the reason I am using it as the hook, as it were. In the media, we call it a hook. Do I got you hooked? I got you hooked. I think I got you hooked. Because this interview you're going to hear, this conversation that you're going to be witness to and be involved in, is 6 months old. And there's really about 7 excuses as to why that time has passed. I could give you a bunch of them. It really wouldn't matter. But the bottom line was, last November, my friend, the incredible journalist and author, world traveler, Kathleen Falsani, was heading to Ireland to take some of her mother's ashes there. Her mom had passed away. And I've been trying to connect with Kathleen on and off for about 4 or 5 years. And we go back to our Harpo days. You'll hear about that in just a second. But her journey and the journey that her husband, Maurice, and her son, Vasco, have been on, I'm stuttering. And I'm not even going to take the stuttering out. I usually do. I am kind of verklempt and always at a loss for words when I am reminded or I see something about this amazing, amazing miracle journey that these people have been on. And so that's been sitting there for 6 months. We talked last November and a lot of stuff was going on. And so that's been sitting there for 6 months and I wanted to kind of angle it here. It didn't work then. Then this past week, I saw a post by Kathleen that said this was the 10-year anniversary of the Gotcha Day. This is the day that Maurice and Kathleen got Vasco. He was able to become part of their family. And I'm obviously she's going to tell you, and you're going to hear this, how this all happened. And if I were to take like a list of miracles, not like walking on the water miracles or feeding 4,000 people with a loaf of bread miracles, I'm talking about the miracles that occur in our lives that we could never plan, can't even really prepare for, I don't think, but somehow, some way, there's an intent behind some of the things that happen in our lives that is just so inexplicable that it just, the only thing you can say is that it's grace. That it's grace bestowed on us at certain times in our life, whether we deserve it or not. And this miracle, really, of Kathleen and Maurice and Vasco, if I take five things that I've had in the 61 years I've been alive, and out of those 61 years, I'm probably coherent, what, maybe 57 of them? I don't know. This is in the top five. I was witness to watching this when it took place in real time 10 years ago. She and I had a conversation about this a decade ago, and here we are 10 years later, and it catches me sometimes because with all the shit that's going on in the world, it is miracles like these that make every moment matter. So we'll pick this up. This is from last November 2019, but everything we're talking about applies just as much today. And the other part of this interview that you need to know about is a book that's out. We'll be talking about the book, and it's Kathleen and her co-author have this book about hunger and dealing with hunger issues and helping people. So there's some of that in here too. And on the back end of this, I'm going to tell you how you could do something specific. Maybe with some of that stimulus money that you got, I got a place you could park it, do a lot of good. All right, let's get to it. I spent almost 5 years building the Oprah Radio Network back in the day. We'll just leave it at that. But it was a chunk of time that was really important for me because I found what Oprah was up to and the branding and the messaging she had back then to be in line with it. I thought was important to have broadcast and people could have access to. One of the shows that I was assigned to, because nobody else wanted the show, but I knew how to handle this guy, Dr. Oz. And we obviously covered all these medical miracles and maladies and all these different things, thousands of shows over a period of time. And right towards my tenure there, right towards the end of my tenure there, I should say, I was introduced to Kathleen Falsani through a mutual friend who worked at Harpo. And we kind of got off to the side. And in about 3 minutes of talking, I thought, I'm not putting her on with Dr. Oz. I'm going to put her on my show. That's not going to happen. So I'm going to keep her to myself. And we did a great show. And somewhere in the vast archives of the internet, that interview still resides from 10 years ago. And she was known then worldwide and is still known today around the world as God Girl. She's a best-selling author. The book's called The God Factor, one of my favorite, Inside the Spiritual Eyes of Public People. The one that just beat my butt right into the ground, Sin Boldly, A Field Guide for Grace. Of course, The Dude Abides, The Gospel According to the Coen Brothers. And it goes on from there. But now she has a new book out. It's called The End of Hunger. She is working with Jenny Eaton Dyer on this book. And it's really about renewing the hope for feeding people around the world. And there's contributors, much like some of her other books, including Rick Bayless and William Frist, Jeffrey Sachs, and the Paisleys, go figure, Brad and his wife Kimberly. And it's great stuff. And I've caught her in a small room in the Newark airport on her way to Ireland. So your travels apparently knows no bounds. How you doing?
I'm good. It's really nice to hear your voice, John. It's been way too long.
Yeah, it's at least 10 years. And do you remember that interview? It was just the two of us studio. And it's somewhere I got to find it. Either you have it or I have it. I don't know. It's somewhere, but we'll find it.
I'll have to look. Yeah, I feel like that needs to be shared again.
Yeah, I think so too. Before we get into the book, and I told you this off the air, this is always about full disclosure with you. Number one, if people don't know about the biggest miracle has to be in your life, and certainly in the top five in mine, was the story about your son Vasco. And I'm going to let you tell it because I would just be interrupting and probably be off base somewhere. But it was such a profound witness to me, the real concept of grace, which is you put so eloquently. Yeah. So you can just kind of help that a little bit?
Sure, I'll try to do the 25-cent version because okay. It's quite a long story. Nice. But I'll hit the highlights.
Right.
So I am and was a journalist. 12 years ago, I was the religion writer for the Chicago Sun Times. My husband is also a journalist. He covered criminal justice for the Chicago Tribune, and a number of years before that, I kind of made my name in Chicago newspapers in part from a series I did with a guy from Ireland named Bono, the lead singer of U2.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, you've heard of him?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In December of 2002, I heard from the younger sister of my best friend who was working in the contracts department at Live Nation that, she said, U2 was getting doing a bus tour of the Midwest. I'm like, no, they're not. This is in 1985.
Right.
They're definitely not doing that. She's like, no, seriously. I'm looking at this writer. It's something it mentions Bono. A year or two before that, my husband and I had become acquainted with Paul McGinnis, who was U2's manager at the mm-hmm. time. And so I reached out to him and said, what the hell is this bus tour thing? He goes, oh, yeah, no, that's not us. It's something Bono's doing. Here's the name of the publicist who's handling that. And her name was Jennifer Bluestein. And this is the early days of Google. I relentlessly tried every number I could find for her online until I found her.
Mm-hmm.
And talked my way onto this bus. It was a tour for Data Debt Aid Trade Africa, which is the precursor to the One campaign. And what they were doing at the time was driving across the Midwest, essentially trying to get the evangelical church, the evangelical Christian community, to respond to the AIDS emergency in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And my wonderful editors at the Sun Times said, if you can get on the bus, you can totally go. And I did. And for 2 weeks, I think it was, we had conversation after conversation with Bono, talking about the activism that he was doing and had been doing for many years in Africa and elsewhere, and why. And it was all based around his faith and blah, blah, blah. I come off the road after a couple of weeks of this with front page stories every day with me and the rock star and
right.
various people. And I walk into some bar in Chicago, and way in the back of the room is Bill Zaney. Bill Zaney's a very well-known, celebrated magazine writer. And mm-hmm. he's 6'7", if I'm not mistaken.
Big Bill.
Big guy, tall guy. And has this great flat Chicago accent. And all I hear from this booming voice from the back of the bar is, hey, God, girl. And that's where the nickname came from.
That's where it started.
To give you that part of it. So I continued to write about issues in and around Africa with HIV and AIDS and other things for a number of years, and got my first book contract. Bono was in that book, gave some money away as a way to say sort of to tithe the project. The One campaign doesn't accept individual donations, so I asked his organization, can you tell me a couple of different groups somewhere in Africa who need money right now? And his assistant, Lucy, gave me three names. One was in Mali, one was in Uganda, and one was in Malawi.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked the road less traveled by, because that's just how I am in the world, and I picked Malawi. And it was an organization that worked with street kids. We sent some money off. Didn't really think much of it. We got the yearly reports for a few years, and then 2007 rolls around, and I am working on my second book, and it's a memoir of a kind about the idea of grace.
Mm-hmm.
What does it feel like? What does it sound like? What does it smell like? What does it taste like when you encounter grace in the wild? So this is a book about grace for people who are not theologians, who don't really, maybe who are unchurched, don't want anything to do with religion, but what does it feel like when you are face-to-face with grace?
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking at some stories in my own life, and then I started taking some trips. I went to Ireland, my favorite place in Ireland, to try to figure out what draws me to that place. I went to Western Montana and spent all of Passover and Easter with the only resident rabbi in the entire state at the time, Alan Setcher and his wife, Ina Albert, who have since become family to me. And then at some point, my husband said, well, why don't we take that trip to Africa? And what he meant by that trip to Africa was a 2-week trip for two people, all expenses paid, to East Africa that we had won earlier that year in a raffle.
Get out of here.
That that Deborah Pickett, who was another columnist at the Sun Times, she was going to be doing a hike up Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. And as a fundraiser, she was selling tickets to this Global Alliance for Africa. It's a Chicago-based smaller NGO. To their banquet, and we couldn't go to the banquet. She said, well, I have raffle tickets. I said, sure, I'll take 10. And I never win anything.
Right.
I'd never won anything before. So I put them in my drawer and forgot about them. And then, you know, 6 weeks later, get a call on my way to interview somebody else and find out that we had won this trip, which was just, like, staggering in and of itself. And so fast forward, you know, 6 months or a year, was coming up on our 10th anniversary. My husband, Maury, said, well, why don't you work on this book about Grace? I know you need more material. Why don't we go to Africa and see where Grace shows up? So, all right, we planned this trip. And it was 2 weeks to go to Kenya, Zanzibar, Tanzania, and we asked if we could add on to it and go to Malawi just to check out this organization, see if they needed more help from us. And so in the middle of this long trip, we go to Malawi for like 3 days. And at the end of the first full day we were there, where we had gone and met all these boys, largely boys, who used a drop-in center where they would go once a day and get something to eat. Maybe get help with schoolwork if they were in school. They had little plots of land out and back where they could grow a little bit of something. And we were, it was really moving and a profound experience with these young men. And we were going back to our hotel, Pedro's Motel, and our guide from the organization said, would you mind stopping and meeting one more boy? He's just kind of special. That's all he told us. And I can picture this in my mind as vividly as it had happened 10 seconds ago. Maury and I look at each other in the back of this ramshackly van, and I know all we want to do is go back and have a beer and go through the photos and process what we've done, but we went, why not?
Sure.
Okay. So we drive out towards the airport road, and like most countries, the road to the airport is not the nicest part of town, and pulled over and scrambled, sort of climbed down this embankment, and there's a little sort of clutch of mud and wattle huts, and this guy yells something, and out of one comes this little tiny boy, probably 30 pounds, like the size of a four-year-old American kid, skinny, but with these huge eyes and this very sort of regal look to his face. And he goes over, he sits on the other guy's lap, and we start talking, and other family members come out, and eventually the boy comes and sits on my lap. And it was a few minutes into the conversation where, you know, suddenly your eyes focus and you realize you're seeing something that had been there the whole time, but you're just not realizing it.
Yeah, yeah.
His heart was beating so fast and so violently that it was moving my chest. And I looked at him and I saw that his eyes were kind of rheumy and he was panting and his hair was a little bit yellow around the sides. And I knew he had been asleep. That's what they told me. They woke him up when he came out. And I turned and I said, what's wrong? Is he ill? And they said, oh, yeah, he was born with a hole in his heart. And we're like, oh, my goodness. Well, what did the doctor say? Well, he's seen a doctor, and his aunt yells, and one of the other kids goes into her hut and brings out a chest x-ray that they'd had in this little wrinkled manila folder, and we hold it up to the light, and you can see his shoulders and the top of his ribcage, and then just a huge black shadow where his heart is. That it was so oversized that it was, you know, like all this was. And a little tiny bag of what looked like aspirin, and that's all he had. And we could just tell very quickly that this kid was not doing well. And so we had about 36 hours left on the ground. And we tried to get him help. We tried to appeal to the man who ran the organization that we'd given money to that works with street children over there, as in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. There's an entire generation of people my age missing who died because of HIV/AIDS. And there are all these kids, and at that time, and it's changed a little bit now, but not much, there's a cultural thing against adoption. Like, you certainly didn't adopt somebody who was from outside your country. And you didn't even adopt somebody who was Malawian who wasn't somehow related to you. It just wasn't done. So you had all these kids who were orphaned and needed homes, but there was this sort of, it was verboten for one reason or another. And there were very few orphanages. Mm-hmm. And some of the ones that existed at that time were not very good anyway. So you had this big problem, and this was an organization that tried to alleviate it in some sense, at least get these kids one meal a day, at least have them some place where they can interact with adults who weren't trying to exploit them. So this little guy, whose name was Vashko, come to find out he was the smallest and the youngest kid they'd ever seen living on the street.
Wow.
In Blantyre, Malawi, which is one of the two main cities. One was in the north, one's in the south. This is the one in the south. And that it took them weeks to get him to trust them enough to come and have a bowl of porridge. He was very wily. Anyway, we talked to the guy who runs the place. He said something to the effect of, I'm aware of his Vashko's situation. There are just so many children, and there's only so much we can do. And we knew this guy was going to do nothing, either because he couldn't or he just wouldn't.
Sure.
And we had to leave. And I remember stopping to see Vashko on the way back to the airport and hugging him and doing exactly what the organization asked us not to do when we got there, which was be emotional in front of anybody and make any promises. But at that point, we've been so good everywhere else we went. And I just couldn't help myself. I told him that I loved him, and I said that we would do everything we could to help him, and that we would see him again. And then I got on a plane and ugly cried and howled my way back to Tanzania so badly that the pilot came back to ask if I was all right. And I remember sitting there in the seat just outraged that this kid was going to die because he was poor and African. I remember as the plane took off from Blantyre, I looked down at the lights of the city. I thought of how many times have I looked down at the lights of the city in Chicago. And I thought, even the poorest kid, even a homeless orphan in Chicago would at least be at Strother Hospital that night, getting at county, getting some kind of help. And I was just kind of inconsolable until I remembered something that Bono had told me those years before when I was asking about, you know, sort of the devil's advocate question about, why bother? There's so much need. It's never going to go away. And aren't you throwing good money after that? All these questions my editors asked me to ask him.
Right.
And he said, you know what, Kathleen? We can't do everything, but what we can do, we must do. And I remember thinking, well, I'm not Madonna. I can't airlift a kid out of here on my own. I'm not a doctor. I can't fix this part. I'm not a politician. I'm not a millionaire. But I am a writer, and I have a platform. So I can tell a story, and I did. A couple weeks later, when we got back from Africa, and I wrote about it in my Friday column in the Sun Times. And the next day, by the afternoon of the next day, six surgeons in three hospitals had been in touch with me saying, if you can get them here, we'll fix the part, which was extraordinary. And, you know, so moved. And then random hundreds of readers just started sending money to the newspaper, so much so that we had to set up a trust fund for Vashko to put the funds in. Thousands of dollars came in.
Wow.
And we started to figure out how to get him to the States. And it took 18 months with lots of red tape. He had malaria at least once. Not quite sure how he survived, but he did. And then arrived at the end of April 2009, had the heart surgery about 6 weeks later, and came out of it perfectly. And in the time that he was in the hospital, before the day, actually the day he was moving from a ICU room into a regular room, was the day that the High Court of Malawi overturned a lower court verdict that had said Madonna could not adopt a second child from Malawi. She adopted her son David, who's from the north. She was trying to adopt a girl called Chifundo Mercy, who was from the same town as Vashko, and the lower court had said no. And she appealed, bless her heart, and her chutzpah and they overturned it. And we were standing there in the hospital watching the crawl on CNN, and another one of those turned to each other and went, I don't know what kind of court system they had, but that sounds like case law.
Mm-hmm.
And it was. And we worked with the State Department to basically keep Boshko in country with us while he was recovering from his heart surgery and do the international adoption backwards. And a year later, we were living in California by this time. At the very last week of school of his fourth grade year, he became legally forever, our child. And then we had to go back to Malawi with him for the court hearing, not knowing if we'd be able to get him back out of the country. And we're sitting in this courtroom in judge's chambers, with this completely poker-faced Malawian judge who wrote his opinion out longhand on yellow legal paper. And it wasn't until he said, I'm bound by the case of Mercy James, and I knew that was Madonna's daughter, that I knew he was ruling in our favor. And he did.
Listen,
so God bless Madonna.
Listen. I sit and listen to this every time, and I'm a trout out of water, my mouth hang open. You win a trip out of nowhere. You throw a dart, you pick Malawi out of one of three places. You went there to write about what was going on and do what you can, but not get emotionally connected. You lock eyes with this little boy, and all these dominoes fall in your favor. And yep. Now, and I said this before we started even doing this interview, now when I look at a picture of this kid, he should be on the cover of GQ.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's a
he really is beautiful.
But I mean, Kathleen, do you ever, you must. I mean, sometimes when something happens really amazing and you're in it, you don't see it as clearly, do you still even talking about it now go, holy man, it's really unbelievable.
Yeah. It's never lost on any of us how extraordinary this story is. And I think I forgot one of the bits when I'm telling the story. You know, I was working about the book about grace, and we went over there sort of looking for grace in Africa. And when we met Boshko, he was wearing a t-shirt with the name of the organization and a dove on it. And the name of the organization was Chisomo, which we later learned is grace in his native language. So, like,
of course,
you know, I'm a little dense. God sort of needs flashing lights and arrows. Like, this is happening. Mm. This is what you should do. I'm speaking to you. This, so, you know, it's just many ups and downs and ins and outs and divine reversals along the way. And now he's 20 years old and perfectly healthy and in the process of raising funds himself to go study in Madagascar for a semester next year. We're really proud of him. He's an exceptional young man.
If you don't mind, because I think this is important, while that is vibrant and beautiful and divinely sent, has not been without its difficulties.
No, it has not. No, it has not. An unexpected one, in fact. So, you know, after the 2016 election, we live in a lovely, lovely surf town in Southern California where Timothy Leary once lived. It's known for its artists, and it's a true surfing town. It has that sort of ethos about it. It's rather progressive. There are a lot of open-minded, politically active people. For a long time, it was sort of a little blue island in the middle of bright red Orange County, but that's changing now. Orange mm-hmm. County is more purple now than it used to be. You know, Boshko was one of only a handful of African-American kids in town, although there are plenty of people who have adopted internationally. There's all kinds of Hispanic and Asian kids, and there's blended families, and it was never an issue. In fact, if it were an issue when we first got there, it was in the opposite direction. He wasn't just accepted. I mean, who wants to just be accepted or tolerated? He was celebrated. Like, the town just, mm-hmm. you know, everybody was great to him. They loved the story when we would share it, and they were just loving. And it's a very sort of Mayberry by the Sea kind of place where we don't really lock our doors. And
right.
Kids are kind of free range, but in a good way, because there's always parents around. So somebody who's got eyes on your kid. And it was a beautiful place for this child whose first 9 years were so fraught and so insecure to live the next 10 years of his life. But very unfortunately, a few days after Christmas 2016, my brother had come to visit. My brother is an Air Force lieutenant colonel in the Air Force and had just been back from 6 months being deployed in combat fighting mm-hmm. ISIS. And we had just sat down in our living room to have some Thai food. And even at Christmas time in Laguna, it's sort of indoor-outdoor living. So our front door is open, the back door is open. There's sort of a breeze. The sun's just going down. It's kind of cozy. And all of a sudden, we hear some yelling and then a thud. And we go to the front door and realize there's a pickup truck with some kids in it who had just thrown a watermelon at the front door and were yelling Boshko's name. And fortunately, he was the last one up, so he didn't hear some of what was said. I didn't hear some of what was said, but my brother heard it, mm-hmm. and my husband heard it. And we were just sort of dumbfounded by what had just happened. And even without saying much, Boshko knew exactly what and why that had happened and just would have retreated to his room to sit very quietly and seethe and journal while his investigative reporter parents went.
Right.
And a highly trained uncle went to work, and he found a video from our next door neighbor's surveillance that got you could see the truck, which my brother looked at and was able to identify exactly the make and model and part of the plate. And my husband had cleaned up the watermelon, and there was a shard that had a sticker on it, you know, with the zipper code. Mm-hmm. Like these stupid kids could not have picked the worst family to pull this shit on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I fished that out, and we started calling around. There's only a few new grocery stores in town, and we called down to the Ralphs, just like from the Big Lebowski. We called down to the Ralphs and said, do you sell many watermelons? I said, yeah. I said, can I speak to the manager, please? Sure. And everybody knows everybody in this town.
Sure.
Do you remember in the last few hours a group of boys coming through and buying watermelons? She goes, oh, yeah, they were really loud and obnoxious. They were carrying them around the store and chanting. It's like, is there CCTV for that? She goes, I'm sure. And there was. And on which we could identify who all the boys were.
Mm-hmm.
And we were shocked because we knew some of them. They were all athletes. Boshko was an athlete as well. And we worked with the police in Laguna. And the very first police officer to walk into our house was a detective named Cornelius, who was the very first African-American police officer in the town that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And also happens to be a person of faith and could not have been a more perfect person to walk into our family in the midst of crisis and be a source of calm and peace and comfort and faith. And you know, we're still in touch with him. And,
mm.
It became this long kind of protracted, the kids were out of school, the police asked us not to say anything until the kids could be back in school where they could talk to them all at once. And of course, once that happened, then people knew what happened.
Right.
You know, 90% of the people that we heard from in town were outraged. And there was a small group that thought we were the ones who were the problem.
Sure. That's kind of how it usually plays out, doesn't it? It's like a 90-10 yeah. ratio these days.
Right.
All days, yeah.
Yeah.
Most
people were great. Some people were not, and unfortunately some of those were the parents of the boys.
Oh, sure.
Who did this. And it was really tough, and I wanted, you know, I'm very protective, and I thought if this is we live in a very expensive place where we live,
right.
We purposely sort of overextend ourselves to live there because we thought we were keeping him safe. And if this is sort of nonsense that's going to happen, then yeah. I wanted to get him out of there as soon as possible and head back to Chicago or somewhere else. But that never came together. And we stayed and wrote it out. And it was really hard.
And now now, you know, that... And part of this, as you write about in so many of your books, you know, and mm-hmm. and it's not always easy finding grace, and being have grace put upon us at times. Rarely yeah. does it show up like it does in church or in, you know, Charlton Heston movies, right?
Right.
With Lizzie
and the
Lodge
says, with art music and
right.
like,
yeah, exactly.
Like we stars. No, sometimes it's a difficult grace. I mean, he's 20, but he's a young 20. He doesn't have the same feeling largely as most of the kids in his cohort of like, can't wait to get out of our house because
right,
he hasn't
right,
been in it for
right,
20 years.
Right.
He hasn't been in it for 10.
Right.
But we've now reached the point where it's like, okay, yeah, you need to go somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's switch gears just a little bit, because your work has always fascinated me because of your background. I mean, you graduated Wheaton College just outside of Chicago here. You got a
mm-hmm.
master's in journalism from Northwestern, which is on the other side near the water, and a mm-hmm. master's in theological studies from Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. But when I read your stuff, it doesn't sound like what it should from those backgrounds.
Thank you.
Yes. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I'm like, you're in plain speak, and they're talking, you know, over here somewhere.
Yeah, I was just saying, I went to Wheaton. No, that Wheaton.
Yeah,
they figure the one in Massachusetts. I'm like, no, the other one.
Yeah, the other one.
You know, in fairness, not everybody who comes through that school in particular comes out in a, you know, Franklin Graham shaped cookie cutter, tiny minded, and I would say even tinier heart shaped model. And by the way, he wasn't smart enough to get into Wheaton, so he didn't go to Wheaton, but his dad did. So yeah, there's a lot of diversity within what I would have called evangelicalism. Whatever we're calling evangelicalism today doesn't look anything like anything I recognize. But I just prefer not to use the word anymore because it's lost all of its meaning. They can have it, whoever these people are. That doesn't have anything to do with Christ, as far as I can tell. But yeah, I was lucky. I had great professors. I had a great cohort of friends. I was in the theater. I was in the newspaper. So I had a very different experience than somebody else, perhaps at the same time coming through Wheaton, who was a political science major or played football or was an econ. I mean, you could have come through and not had any of the great liberal-minded professors that I was fortunate to study with, but I did.
Yeah.
And you know, some of my best friends in the world to this day are my friends from Wheaton. That's why we live in Laguna Beach. We moved to live near a group of friends of mine from college, and Bosco's godfathers are both from Wheaton. And you know, there are good ones out there who are still changing the world and still being disruptors and being vanguards for the kind of change that we want to see in a more just
world. Maybe you can answer a long-standing question for me, because I'm not of that mindset. I think you go where you're called, and you bloom where you're planted, and you doesn't matter what church you go to, that you're the church and all that kind of stuff we kind of agree on. What is the fascination? See, when I hear the word evangelical, I think of like Ernest Angley. I mean, old school stuff and some of these TV evangelists. What is the attracting factor where it seems like, and I'm just going to, you know, this is from my observation only, that it's more about talking about God than actually representing what God said to do. What's the fascination there?
That's interesting. Well, I think for some Christians, it's about right belief, whether you have the right theology and believe the correct things, and by extension, are therefore behaving in the correct fashion and saying the magic words the right way in the right order. But it really has very little to do with an actual relationship with the divine, with Jesus Christ, and with anybody else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jesus came to, I mean, if all God needed to accomplish was to have a clearer set of rules, he could have sent down another book. Or another. Instead, he sent his kid to be in relationship with us. And so it's all about relationship. And the primacy of all of that is love. And so if that's not at the forefront of everything you do, every decision you make, if it's not led by love for other, love for God, you're doing it wrong. So, you know, Anne Lamott, who is a believer like I am, says, you know, you have to choose sometimes. Are you going to be right or are you going to be loving?
Yeah.
And loving is always the correct response.
It's almost like a, God, you know, I'm trying to get the right words because I'm going to get mail no matter what I say, but that, who cares? I've been doing it for 20 years.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's just, we just get it in different ways for different reasons, but it's the same people saying the same shit. And I'm fascinated. It's almost, you know, some, I can't quite get my finger on it. And I have,
Bono likes to call it a bless me club.
Bless me. I have more people, I've had more people in my life that kind of used to be like that. And it's like one day they woke up out of a trance and they're like, what happened here?
What was I thinking? What is that? And I think we're seeing a lot of people waking up to that right now, especially the younger generation. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm married to a boomer raising a young millennial. Mm-hmm. And millennial kids are just passing us by.
No doubt.
They woke up when they were, they got woke when they were 10 and looked around them and went, that's nonsense. And good for them.
Yeah. You know, you and I, and Maury, probably he's a little bit older than me, but not much. We had these social influences. We had, you know, the Hunger Project started back in the 70s. We knew this stuff was going on. And there were a lot in music, there was a lot of social consciousness put out. And I don't listen to a whole lot of the radio today. And if it is, it's the 60s and 70s channel. So I'm locked in. But those influences, I don't see them as prevalent anymore. And I wonder how that affected our generation, because I still do things really based on growing. I remember the first time I heard, must have been Cat Stevens doing Peace Train. It was Cat Stevens doing Peace Train. But it was set up, I went to the Irving Park Presbyterian Church, and the pastor was a guy named Bob Sills. He looked like Teddy Roosevelt, so I was in right out of the gate. Oh, he did. Looked just like him. He would wear a powder blue leisure suit and white boots under his robes.
Right? Yeah,
oh,
baby.
Right? He used to tell the story how God tapped him on the shoulder when he was picking cotton and said, Bob G, it's your time. And I'd say, Bob, does God have an accent? He goes, well, yeah.
You know,
but my influence there came from one night when we were in a youth group and somebody decided to play that song on a Friday night service around Christmas time or something. And then we were all, there was like six or eight of us in the youth group, and the song would come on and we would stand up and say something about peace in the world. I was probably 12, 13 years old. And to stand up in this congregation of really old people back then was a huge, daunting task. But I also realized all these years later, the words to that song, what Cat Stevens was insisting on back in the day, and the combination of all those elements is in some ways part of the reason I still do what I do now.
Well, I tell you, man, I can trace everything from my family to the book that just came out to where I'm headed later today to sitting in front of my TV when I was 14 years old watching Live Aid broadcast live from Wembley and from Philadelphia and watching my favorite band, U2, get up there and sing, and but all these people, all these musicians, and I loved music, all coming together to sing for a change to help the people who were starving in the famine in Ethiopia. And that's when I realized that, like, popular music, popular culture, and young people actually can make a difference. It started me paying attention to what was happening in Africa, paying attention to some of my favorite artists who continued from then on to be activists, to do charitable work, whether it's for hungry people, whether it's for HIV and AIDS, what have you. And, you know, we were just talking to, somebody the other day about this, you know, so that's deep in me, deep in me. My son, even let's pretend he didn't come from where he came from. He's not hearing they're not singing about the same kinds of things. They're singing about other kinds of injustices, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
And I think we're starting to see more of this sort of political, social change music coming. I was just listening to the new tracks off of the Coldplay album and a couple of new tracks from Mumford & Sons, and it's certainly there, and I think we're going to see more of it. But it did sort of, like, around the issue of hunger, for instance, we were all over that in the 80s,
right.
All over it.
Right.
And then it kind of got subsumed, as it should have in some ways, by the AIDS emergency in sub-Saharan Africa, which we have done such great work on alleviating so much suffering there. We don't call it the emergency anymore. There are twice as many people on life-saving drugs now than there were in 17 years ago when Bono got off the bus to go across the Midwest.
Sure.
And in part, some of that change came about because the church did wake up and did start to talk about it. And pastors started to preach about it, and they started talking to their conference people about it. And that's why we have PEPFAR, which is one of the most successful health-related programs in U.S. history. That was started by George W. Bush, of all people.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we're hoping is that with this book, the title is The End of Hunger, and the subtitle is my favorite part, A Renewed Hope for Feeding the World. We have cut in half the number of people living in extreme poverty in the last generation. We've also cut in half the number of people living with hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now within striking distance of meeting one of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which is to end hunger globally by 2030. We've got 10 years. And experts, including somebody like Jeffrey Sachs, who is one of the contributing authors to the book, who was one of the authors of the Sustainable Development Goals, says it is possible. We have the means. We just need the will. We have enough food. We have the technology. We have enough money to feed everybody. We just have to make sure that the people who need it most get it.
I just want to kind of couch this for people. As you mentioned, it's called The End of Hunger, Renewed Hope for Feeding the World. Just to get these numbers spot on, 25 years ago, 23.3% of the world's population lived in hunger. That's a lot of human beings. And today, that number's down to 12.9%, give or take a little. It's progress. And in the day and age that we live in now, rare is it that we see progress anywhere. So this is a really, really big deal. And right above all this is the reminder that Jesus' command was very clear. We are.
Oh, yeah, by the way.
Yeah. Go ahead. By the way, there's a reason for all this. It's because not just because you have nothing else to do. Go ahead.
Well, and it wasn't. You can argue about, what did he say exactly about women, or what does St. Paul say about women seeking the church, or what does he say about divorce? Or, no, it's very, very clear with four different sources that Jesus said, feed the hungry. And it wasn't a suggestion. It was a command.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're calling yourself a follower of Christ and you're not doing anything to take care of, to clothe the naked, to shelter the homeless, to make sure that orphans and widows are taken care of, and if you're not doing anything to get water to the thirsty and food to the hungry, you're doing it wrong. If you're not doing those basic things that he asked about, I don't care how great your preaching is, I don't care how complicated and sound your theology is, if you're not doing that, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. And that stuff gets lost. That is a very fundamental, simple thing that anybody listening to this podcast
can do. Central to the gospel.
Central. You don't need anybody's permission. You don't need anybody's permission, right? It's already been given. Yeah.
Yep. And we've lost sight of that as a people. And that's one of the things that we want the book to do, is to get people talking about it again. I was in an interview a few days ago with my friend Jonathan Martin, who is a wonderful writer and a speaker and a pastor. And I said, Jonathan, when is the last time you heard somebody stand in the pulpit or in the Bema or wherever, or jumping around the stage with the Madonna mic on, and give a message about physical hunger? I can't remember the last time. And maybe it's time that we sort of throw a gauntlet down to our fellow clergy people and say, how about this Thanksgiving, or how about sometime between now and the end of the year, you spend time and put together a message about hunger and remind your people that we're supposed to be helping.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be making sure that our neighbors, whether they're down the street or across the world, have enough to eat.
There's no lack of places to put your money or your time, or even here in Chicago, every Jewel food store has a table set up starting right before Thanksgiving, and all you got to do is buy a couple extra cans, and they'll take care of it. The churches where you live, I mean, there's all sort of resources that people can find to do this, but it is bringing it back front and center to mind. Is that why? I mean, look, when Brad Paisley speaks, you know, people listen. When Rick Bayless cooks dinner, I'm going there, but I also listen. And this whole eclectic group was put together. What was the main thrust of getting this particular group of humans together? What was the outcome you were looking for?
Dr. Jenny Dyer, a brilliant woman with a PhD and has worked in advocacy and in policy for 25 years. She and I met on that bus trip with Bono.
Are you kidding?
No, that's when we met almost 20 years ago, when she was really young, starting out, and before she had her PhD, and all the great success that she's had over the years working with various people, including Senator Frist. She ran his organization in Nashville for many years. We realized that if you're talking about an issue that is as simple but also as complicated as hunger, you have to, and you want to get as many people possible to engage with it, then you have to have different voices taking different approaches to it. Jenny remembers data and numbers like nobody's business. Mm. As much as I have post-it notes all over the cell, I have to write the statistics down on my hand, even though I've read them and written them how many times before I go on an interview, I have to make sure I have something nearby because I just don't retain information that way. But if you tell me a story that moves me, I will never forget it and I will become your greatest champion. And so we realized that we wanted to have those kinds of all different voices talking about this in all different ways, personally, as experts, as economists. Rick Bayless's chapter is a marvelous chapter. It's called When You Eat, Sit Down. He's talking about what he has done over the years in his restaurant to be equitable and to be sustainable and to be environmentally friendly. And then he does a load of work around hunger locally and globally. But he's just talked about simple things that changes he made years ago in his kitchen, simple things that you can do in your own home that you think like, what difference does it make if you throw away 4 tablespoons of that good olive oil or save it to use it later? I mean, there's so much. He's like, yeah, but if you don't, if you start doing it and somebody else starts doing it, it eventually adds up.
Right.
We have people in here who are our partners talking about how they're raising their children. Brad Paisley and Kimberly Williams Paisley talk about how the lessons that they learned when they were younger from their parents about our responsibility for our neighbors and about food and what they have done with their children. And they have just started this remarkable charity in Nashville called The Store. And it's a food pantry, but when you walk in, it looks just like a regular grocery store. And you get a basket and you get to go up and down the aisles and choose things out just like you would if you were at The Jewel or, you know, Ralph. And her boys, their boys who are young, they're school age, they named it The Store because it feels like a store. And that was about giving dignity to the people who had food insecurity. Mm. So they weren't just getting scraps from the table or like the weird can of beets from the back of your pantry. There's another chapter in here that I absolutely love by Rachel Marie Stone, who's a food writer, is a parent, is an educator, and she talks about, you know, making sure that your family eats promiscuously, but you're trying foods from other parts of the world so that you're not looking down on somebody else's food choices. She also tells a story about being involved in a mitten drive at a very affluent school where I think she was teaching that in Connecticut, and how this one mom brought these mittens, a number of pairs of mittens that were from the very expensive children's store in town where most of the people whose children went to that school, they bought their clothes. And somebody said, oh my goodness, how nice of you to get the really nice ones for this charity thing. And she said, why wouldn't I want to give it for charity? They should be the nicest thing. And so Rachel sort of makes the point of like, if you're going to give away if you're giving food to a pantry and you're buying, this is a little off topic with Hunter, but saying you're buying something for Toys for Tots, get the good stuff.
That's right.
In my conversation with Jonathan Martin the other day, I'm like, if you're going to give canned peas, get them the Sure canned peas. Spend the extra 70 cents and get the really nice peas to give to somebody else.
That's right.
The book is designed so that you can pick up any chapter written from any perspective and have some solid action that you can take right away to start making a change.
And I'm going to make sure people know right now the book is available at Amazon, of course. Now, listen, full disclosure, yes. I'm not a huge fan. I like the world better when Amazon was just a river.
Yeah, me too.
It's pretty confusing at times, but you can get the book there. It's The End of Hunger, Renewed Hope for Feeding the World. Contributors, as mentioned, Rick Bayless is in there, and Jeffrey Sachs, and just a whole slew of human beings that are doing some really good work in the world. And it is about awareness and consciousness. And it's like you said, you know, look, if you're going to feed other people, feed them like you'd feed your family. I know there's I was reading the chapter by Amy Grant last night where she said, you know, part of this is about loneliness. Don't just, I mean, if you have the wherewithal, bring people to your table because it creates a sense of community and erases that. Yeah. The last couple of minutes we have together, I have to bounce back to two things because there's a quote that you said years ago that every time I got, you know, my undies in a bundle and I'm jammed up and the shit's hitting the fan and I'm in front of the fan and not behind it. I always go look to this quote, and this is what you said, quote, justice is getting what you deserve. Mercy is not getting what you deserve. And grace is getting what you absolutely don't deserve. Benign goodwill, unprovoked compassion, the unearnable gift. Can you just, first of all, I got goosebumps on my hand, so there we go with that. And secondly, where did that come from, and how's that been like a pivot point for you?
I feel like I might have cribbed some of that from Phil Yancey.
Thanks, Phil.
But, you know, took it a little bit. It's hard to describe grace in just a few words, but that gets closer to what it, for those of us who need to process things cerebrally, that got the closest to what I felt was what grace is. And it certainly feels like that is the experience. That's my experience with grace, is that itself. But kind of, you know, whoa, take your breath away. You've got to be kidding me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even the I dodged a bullet is mercy. The I dodged a bullet and then somebody gave me a basket of puppies and paid my rent.
Right.
And told me that I was beautiful and sat with me and made built a fire for me. Like just sort of
sure.
Things you can't earn. It, one of the descriptions of grace in that book, Spin Boldly, is a lanyap, which is a Cajun word, which means like if you go to the fishmonger and you buy a pound of shrimp and they put an extra handful of shrimp on top of it that they don't charge you for, that's the lanyap.
Oh, nice.
You can't ask for it and you can't pay for it.
It just shows up.
It just shows up and it's yours. You don't earn it. It's just a gift.
Agreed. So the last question that I ask everybody does this show, and I never tell them what the question is beforehand, otherwise they'd be thinking about it the whole time, and I don't want that, mm-hmm. is that when you look at the entire framework of your life, and by the way, you're heading to Ireland. I was so sorry to hear about your mom, but you're actually going to take her home a little bit, aren't you?
A little bit of her, yeah. Some of her ashes are coming with me. I'm going over to join a small group of peace activists from all over the world who are going to walk about 200 miles of the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, in a sort of contemplative, prayerful way. I'm going without any expectations other than hoping to have an open mind, an open heart, and a willingness to listen. And I don't know, there's no end product that I'm expecting to produce. I didn't even bring a camera with me, if you can believe it.
What?
I have my phone. I know. I did it on purpose. Yeah, because I do so much photography. I just thought, you know, I'm just going to bring my iPhone.
Well, that's
it's not about that.
That is a breakthrough for you.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I know.
But Yeah, I know. Because otherwise we'd have 4,000 pictures to sift through on Facebook. You know, who's got time for that anyway? The question is this. When you look at really the entirety of your journey, and however you define that, the framework, your professional life, your personal life, Vashco come into your life, you know, Maury come into your life, these ins and outs, the nuances, the ups and downs, the speed bumps, the fact of the matter that you saw Bono and U2 back in the 80s, and now you hang out with the guy. When you look at all those pieces, what's the big aha for you these days? What's the thing you take away most when you go, damn?
I would say one thing has always been true, and another thing is freshly true. And I'm consciously aware of the truth of the second thing that I'll say. One is I know how deeply I am loved and how precious I am to the universe. I've always known that. I've always, thankfully, always felt that. Even when I don't feel that about myself, something will reflect back to me that you are precious and you are loved. The second thing, which is a more of a new realization to me, is that, and this is completely borrowed from Father Richard Rohr, and that everything belongs. Everything. All the parts of my life that seem to be disparate, that didn't, like, why was I Southern Baptist? Why did I work for Sojourners those few years? That doesn't seem to make any sense, but it all belongs. And everything belongs. And if it feels like it doesn't fit now, wait a few years, and you'll see. It all belongs. Everything belongs, and that takes a lot. That means a lot of different things to me. One of the things that it does is takes the pressure off of me, trying to make sure everybody else is right and has the formula right and said the right words at the right time and believes the correct thing, and all that's ridiculous, because there's a force that's so much greater than all of that, and that force is an unconditional love. And some people call that force God. I certainly do. And everything belongs. Everything belongs in a universe where we are safe and we are loved.
You spend about an hour or so with God Girl, and perspective starts to change. If she's not hanging out with Bono doing whatever they're doing at the time, running around making the world a better place, she walked 200 miles across the island of Ireland. 200 miles along the border. And then she came back. She took her some of the ashes there, came back briefly, had a memorial service for her mom in Connecticut, and then flew to Japan to take the last bit of her ashes there. Her mom had lived there where she was a young civilian teacher for the Air Force kids in the 50s and early 60s. And it was a very long goodbye for her. But this is the kind of thing that these are the people that when you listen to them, you say, I can be better than I am now. This isn't about being better than anybody else than yourself. And the conversation with Kathleen is always uplifting to me. She takes the real nitty gritty approach, you know, to her spirituality. And I have a lot of respect for that. So one of the best ways I know how to put into action everything that Kathleen was talking about with the book about hunger is to support Corbin's legacy. It was established in memory and honor of Corbin Leafman, a dedicated teacher, amazing human being who passed away at the age of 31 from cancer. She's the daughter of my good friend, Joni Leafman. And she was adamant about being remembered not by how she died, by how she lived. I'm always banging on that. You know, how you die is nowhere near as important as how you live. We're all going to die. We don't all live like Corbin did. She was an extraordinarily compassionate and creative kindergarten teacher who taught in schools with disadvantaged students. She made it her mission to never let a child go hungry, not for a meal, a day, or even a weekend. She was known for always walking through the lunch line, holding up a $20 bill to make sure that the cafeteria lady knew that none of her students were to go without a hot meal. So you can find all of that at corbinslegacy.org. I did a show on this a year ago. And I thought, here's a way to put two things together. Now there's three things together. We got the Gotcha Day, when the amazing journey of Vashco comes to Kathleen and Maurice, and they're a family, and it's been 10 years of that. So there's one piece of this for me, this hunger issue that is now apparent once again. It comes and goes. Even though the numbers have dropped worldwide in many ways, here we are now in the middle of this pandemic, and it ain't over yet. Sorry. I know it's nice out, but we need to get our shit in one sock over that. And now that's more than ever, there's a time and a need to feed people that may not have enough. And so, please, you don't have to go out and save the world. All you got to do is make a small donation, and Joni and her team will make sure that no kid goes hungry. All their work at this point are focused in Arizona. I don't care. A hungry kid's a hungry kid. Doesn't matter to me. So I've been on the board. I've known this woman 35 years. It's all on the up and up. And please, if you were touched by what Kathleen was talking about on so many different levels today, please consider going to CorbinsLegacy.org, CorbinsLegacy.org, and make a donation, whether it's $20 or $2,000. Take some of that stimulus money and put it to good use. I know that they will appreciate it. And look, this is what it's all about, right? The ripple effect that's created. You listen to something, and then you take action. And while you may not have to go out personally and do stuff, just a few bucks here and there can make all the difference in the world, especially in the life of a kid that you don't even know. And that's how it works, at least in my experience, observation, and definitely my opinion. It is taking that energy and that comes out of these horrible headlines and transfer that energy into something called lifelines. And one of the best ways you could do it is by helping Corbin's legacy. So thanks very much. Listen, I don't know if you're going to stay home or not. You know, sometimes humans aren't the brightest bulb in the box or the sharpest tool in the shed and a bunch of other metaphors and analogies. But listen, be smart. Life's precious. Be safe. Until next time, adios.